have not voted, get out there and vote. It is Election Day. My guests that I have in the studio today collaborated on a wonderful, wonderful project, but individually, John Slaughter, who in this area, I think that people who know him as an artist know him mainly as a photographer, although he has been involved in film and other projects. He also is a businessman, which a lot of people on that side have known him over the years as a restaurateur. But a really, really talented individual. And also we're being joined by Patrice Melnick, who is a writer and an author and all things literary in St. Landry Parish. She is the founding director of the Festival of Words Cultural Arts Collective. And I am going to mention we do have the Festival of Words coming up this weekend. So you can find out more about that, too, on their website. So welcome, the two of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
And, you know, I do want to say I love this. We have a photographer in the studio, and he came with camera. That's a cool thing to see, John. I would have to think that that's probably a very comfortable kind of position for you to be in, to have a camera in your hand, huh?
Well, I especially like this one because it's really small.
Yeah, yeah.
This has kind of changed the way I do pictures in a way.
You know, now, and I don't know this, is how did photography come into your life?
Oh, I see. I was, my dad was a very good photographer, actually.
He did that, like, for, did he do any of it for a living?
No,
or
he was,
did it?
No, it was just strictly amateur.
Yeah.
But then I was in Northwestern University, and I was taking, I got really interested in film, and I had a friend who was real knowledgeable about the darkroom and so forth. And they had one little course that they were teaching in still photography in the film department, and I took that, and so I really learned the darkroom from this friend of mine who's, and then when I got back to Louisiana, there was so little motion picture work here in the early 70s.
Oh, so
I got more involved in still photography. And
so your main interest initially was film?
More or less.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and I tell people, I just make movies, but they're just one picture at a time.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. You know, I'm going to tell you something, is that one of the things that I absolutely love in life is I love to discover a new talent with somebody that I have known for a long time that I never knew existed. Like, I get a real charge out of that. And it's interesting that film was your first thing, because it wasn't the first thing that I knew about you, and it's something I just learned about you in the last, I don't know what, 2 years, I guess, that you've done some wonderful, like, documentary films that I don't know that a lot of people in this area, until you showed them recently, knew that about you.
I've done a few, not a lot, but a few.
Yeah.
And I'd do more if my son would come back and do some editing for me.
Oh, well, there you go.
Because I really am not good enough at this point in time to work in the digital world.
Yeah.
The editing is very difficult for me to learn.
I do want to bring up one of them that you had done, which was called Prison.
Mm-hmm.
And that you went into Angola.
Right.
And it was very powerful. That was which year that you went
into
there?
1974.
Okay. How did that all come about, get set up to do that?
It's a real good question. I was chosen, I was asked to be the photographer on that by another fellow, George Lane, who concocted this idea in connection with Carlton, forget his first name. He's the academic humanist who had written a book on Angola called Prison.
Okay.
And it was through a grant partially with the National Endowment for the Humanities, or
okay,
the State Endowment.
Yeah.
One of those.
With LEH, okay.
So you had to have an academic humanist involved. And we spent like 3 weeks going up to Angola, living on what they call the farm there.
Yeah.
What was interesting is my dad was a physician there for like 18 months, right when he got out of medical school, because it was during the Depression, and it was the only job he could get that was a steady pay.
Huh.
So I found myself back in, you know, in the place where he had been.
Yeah. Had you spent time around there when, I mean, was your dad, were you in the picture when your dad got out of medical school or no?
No.
That was way before.
Yeah, it was way before.
Okay.
No, but it was interesting. I don't think it probably hadn't really changed that much. Everybody there, you know, is innocent.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it's everywhere, you know.
I could tell you some interesting stories.
But you got into some places there that.
Well, let me tell you a good story.
Tell a good story. Yes, tell one.
We were staying in this place called the Beeline, which is like where a lot of the staff lived and so forth. Well, they had a house there for visitors that you could stay in. And they had like two of the trustees would cook for you. You know, it was great, man. You know, like white tablecloth and iced tea and the whole bit for lunch and everything. And they'd come out and serve the food. So there was a guy in that living in the house at the same time as we were there named I'll think of his name in a minute. Anyway, and he was always giving us a hard time about long hair and all this business and so on and so forth. So a few years later, I was working in a movie theater in Baton Rouge, and he showed up one day with his two daughters in the corner of the movie, you know, and introduced her, you know, and we recognized each other and said hello and so forth. And then several years later, I had a friend who was a guard in Angola, and I told him about, you know, making the film, when we were staying with this doctor. He says, oh, yeah, he says he was in there for embezzlement.
Oh, so Oh, no.
Which he never told us. And here he was going to the theater with his daughters while he was in prison.
How was he getting out? Is what I want to know, John.
Hey, you're asking the wrong person. I have no idea.
Wow. That's a trip. Huh.
He was from Bayou La Batterie.
Wow.
So I think they cut a deal.
Which was a sign.
They needed to have a doctor there, and so he had gotten in some trouble, and probably some federal trouble.
And they said,
look, you can serve your time. You can go be a doctor over there in Angola, and you'll be treated real nice. You can go out to the movies, and you can be served by the trustees.
As long as you take care of everything. That's a trip.
Once again, the doctor in Angola, my father was a doctor. Not under the same circumstances, obviously.
Yeah, so here come the family secrets, John. Let's get that out. is that when that film was completed, where was the first place that was shown? Do you remember?
I don't think it was really ever shown.
Really?
No.
No, when we saw it, meaning whoever the public was that went to see it through Patrice's place, was that one of the first times that you had shown that?
Probably.
Wow.
Well, it was shown briefly when it first came out. You know, it was a film that was sponsored by LITA, which is the forerunner of LPB.
Yeah.
But they have they don't really claim the film.
Okay.
I mean, I don't understand exactly why, but they don't.
It's very powerful.
They don't really. It's not part of their catalog or whatever.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. Well, their loss. You know, because it really is a powerful film. You need to show that in the area again. You also did one called La Boucherie, which takes a look at what everybody knows here in the area is the boucheries, which that again captured so much of just what life is here in this area and a lot of the traditions with that.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It was making fun that film.
And then also Burning Man, which you have made how many trips out to?
I've been there twice.
For people that don't know what Burning Man is, can you just give a little explanation of, and do they refer to it as a festival or an experience?
I'm not sure.
Or a happening.
I don't know how they refer to it. It's probably it's the highest concentration of creativity in an event that you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
A lot of it's driven by people who are very tech savvy out of San Francisco and the rest of California. They now are selling tickets through a lottery system. I think they've held the thing down to 50,000 people.
Wow.
It takes place in the Black Rock Desert, which is near Reno, about an hour from Reno. It's on BLM land, and it's called a playa because it's an actual, like, a dry lake bed, so it's very, very flat.
Yeah.
And they set up a city. They have a grid with the roads and so forth in kind of a crescent shape around a huge area they call Apply, where all the art takes place, the art cars and installations and so on and so forth. It's quite an amazing experience. There's nothing sold there except for ice and coffee, so you have to bring everything in. And when they finish, you take everything with you that you can, and then they walk the desert in a big line, and they pick everything up. So when it's all over, they actually bury cable and everything, you know, before they start, because they have certain things they have to electrify, certain lights and so forth.
Yeah.
So they clean the whole thing up when they leave, and it's been going on and on. It's over, like, over 20 years.
And always in the same piece of property?
Well, it originally started on a beach in San Francisco.
Oh.
And sort of migrated and grew and metamorphosized into this huge affair in the desert. And it's a very brutal environment. It gets very, very hot in the day and very cool at night. And you have dust storms at times that will limit visibility to practically zero.
Yeah.
It's not for the faint at heart. I mean, it's the gutter burning man, especially for somebody my age. You kind of got to get ready. Mentally and physically, you kind of got to get really prepared.
Yeah.
So it's not something. I always say, my idea of Burning Man, the ideal way of Burning Man is they actually have an airstrip that they set up, which is to fly in when the sun goes down, because everything takes place at night, all the art cars and everything, and most of the good things take place. So the airplane lands right at sunset, and then about 2 o'clock in the morning, you get back on your plane and go back to your hotel in Reno. That would be my ideal concept of Burning Man.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, my son has been out there many times. He actually had a camp right on the Esplanade, which is the main road on the edge that faces the playa where all the activity is.
Now, is it juried? I mean, like, for the people that are, like, for the art cars or whoever's doing installations.
You have to submit your car for approval.
Yeah.
To be on the playa, and there is a lot of artwork that is commissioned by the Burning Man folks. You know, they actually commission a lot of artists to do installations.
Yeah.
But then there's all this peripheral stuff that people are doing, and it's way beyond most anything you can really imagine. It's really, you know, it's sort of, I don't know how you would possibly describe it. It's like when people ask me about where I live out in Marfa, Texas. I mean, it's just about indescribable.
Yeah.
You kind of have to go there to get it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and with Burning Man, now when you filmed there, I would imagine quite a difference in equipment that you...
Well, we're using a digital camera, you know. Really, the digital world has changed so many things.
Do you ever go back to, I'm thinking too, with when you do still photography, do you go back to using older equipment?
No, I sometimes think I will, but I probably won't.
Yeah, because it's just...
We got a lot of... For a long time, I was really into printing Cibachrome in the darkroom, which is, you know, a positive-to-positive process. In other words, using a slide as the medium and you're getting a positive print, okay?
Yeah.
So that material is discontinued within the past year, so it's no longer available.
Okay.
So, in a way, the technology is forcing our access to the medium. So, it's progressive. I think it'll probably still hang on in the black and white world.
Yeah.
You know, I think that'll probably maintain itself in a certain way. But in the color world, I mean, it's pretty, and then also that the printing that we're doing now, digital printing, is very archival. It's, I mean, the inks and everything are really hold up well. I mean, it's really a good product.
Yeah.
So it's, in a way, you know, as a friend of mine, Glenn Craddock, said, photography's always been driven sort of by technology. You think about it. So that's just the way it goes.
That's right. Well, we're going to take a little break here. You brought some music with you, John, as did Patrice. Some of the reggae cuts that you brought, can we listen to one of those? Can we just kick off with the first one that you had? Lucky Doobie was the group.
Yeah, and that's interesting because he appeared here twice for the International Festival.
Yeah.
He was the fellow. He was killed in South Africa in a bad incident, but he was like a national hero there.
Yeah.
And he embraced reggae after he had a career, an early career that was not reggae, and then he really took off when he started playing reggae. Very interesting man. I saw him two or three times. Saw him once down in New Orleans, House of Blues. And he has a very high production value in his reggae music. It's very slick.
Well, let's listen to a cut by Lucky Doobie.
A dreadlocks thing, divine conception of the heart. Well, you don't have to dread to be Rasta. This is not a dreadlocks thing, divine conception of the heart. Well, it's a life of a liberty, lived by the fathers of our history. Uphold the ancients and prophecy, trust in the power of the Trinity. Yeah. Got to believe in His majesty, oh yes, His lineage and divinity. The first step is sovereignty, knowing oneself to royalty. You don't have to dread to be Rasta. No, this is not a dreadlock thing, divine conception of the heart. You don't have to dread to be Rasta. This is not a dreadlocks thing, divine conception of the heart. Don't be afraid of your ever burning fire. Trust in your fire and you'll never get burned. Out your fire, your fire gonna lift Rasta higher. You don't have to dread to be Rasta. This is not a dreadlock thing, divine conception of the heart. You don't have to dread to be Rasta. This is not a dreadlock thing, divine conception of the heart. Play, play, play for Rasta, yeah, yeah. Rasta, so we Rasta. Well, oh no, boy. Raga, so we Raga. Well, oh no, boy. Oh, well. Trust in your fire and you'll never get burned. Yes. The fire that rains over heat, air, and water. No water can put out your fire. Your fire gonna lift Rasta higher. You don't have to dread to be Rasta. No. This is not a dreadlocks thing, divine conception of the heart. Yeah. Don't have to dread to be Rasta. No, don't have to dread. This is not a dreadlocks thing, divine conception of the heart. Boy, Rasta, you don't have to dread to be Rasta.
All right. Actually, correction, folks, that was Morgan Heritage. But we have a John likes reggae, so he brought in a variety of reggae songs today. If you're just joining us on The Exchange today, my guests are John Slaughter and Patrice Melnick. And we've been talking with John about just some of his history in other forms of art, mainly film, that he got involved with. But what I do want to turn the focus to now is a new book. And John, this is the first book that you have put out, called Grand Coteau. And as the title lets you know, it focuses on that wonderfully beautiful historic community of Grand Coteau, right north on I-49 from where we're sitting here at the station. I'm curious about, because I think so much of your time here living in the area and in Grand Coteau. I mean, to me, this book would be a compilation of your life in Grand Coteau for quite a while, huh?
Well, it is a 35-year program.
Yeah.
And it is done once you get into the body of the book. The photographs are in chronological order.
Starting like around 1977, huh?
Correct.
Okay. All right.
And so it's... Jesse Poinbuff said it was a love letter to Grand Coteau. I thought that was interesting.
That's a really nice way to put it.
It's an interesting way of putting it.
It really is. Now, and this is put out by the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press.
That's correct.
Right here where the station is located. How did it come about for you to want to do this book?
Well, I've been involved in a lot of other businesses, but continue to do art photography all along.
Yeah.
And people were always asking me if I had a book out, and I always wanted to do a book, but I just didn't have the time or the focus.
It's
to
a
do
lot
it.
Of work.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So when I was going through my slide bank, it just dawned on me that looking at all the images I had, that this would be an obvious thing to do.
Yeah.
And I, fortunately, UL Press took it on. I have to give James Wilson a lot of credit for, you know, pushing this book and believing in the book, so forth. He really deserves a lot of credit. James doing a really good job there. And, you know, this was an interesting enough. We just came back from the book fair in Baton Rouge, and there's really did not see any other books quite like this. So I think that this type of art book, coffee table, I hate to say it called that because there's a lot more to it than that, because we have a lot of historical stuff that Patrice here unearthed from people there and so forth. And
I mean, it's
so it's
be,
more than just that, but I would think it would be still considered by some people to be a coffee table type, you know, art book.
But a lot of people are going to be using it too as a reference book.
Oh, yeah. And I think that was our intention, because when people come to Grand Coteau, they're interested in it, they want to know about it. So if you read all the captions and introduction and so forth, you'll have a pretty good idea of what goes on there and what has gone on there.
That's right. Had you done a project like this before, Patrice?
No, I never have.
Yeah.
This is my first time writing. Usually I write literary nonfiction, memoir. I've written poetry, but I've never done a book where I had to research historical information and where I got to do oral histories, essentially, and interview people and gather information for them to write.
What a fabulous process, you know, for you to be a part of.
I really did enjoy it. But I am working on a oral history project at Casa Azul called Grand Coteau Voices, The Good, The Bad, and The Complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it kind of dovetailed with that project as well, because we had people at the shop come and tell stories in front of an audience. And so it's a similar process of asking people questions and learning information about their past and the changes they've seen and their histories. A lot of when I was interviewing people for the book, a few of them are still living, but many of the people I interviewed are the descendants of people who appear in the book. They're their children or nieces and nephews.
Your families of like properties, because some of the pictures, you know, that are of like properties or, you know, places. So it was families that were connected to those, or people that worked at a...
Yeah, sometimes, like, there was one photograph in there of a butcher shop, and so I got to speak to the man who had worked in that butcher shop at one time, who owned it, and at one time in his life, and so it was very interesting to learn about the workings of it.
Well, and how much, you know, you think of those butcher shops that were in small towns, how much of a community's history went through those shops, you know, just from the customers coming in every day, you know, all the regulars. I mean, think what that man heard over all the years.
Oh, yeah, everybody knew that shop.
Yeah, exactly. You know, John, I want to talk to you about, before we get into more specifics about the book, and what I was telling you is the one thing that I've always been taken by with your work is I don't know that I know the correct terminology, but for me, it's like the vibrancy in the colors that you get in your work.
I really think about myself oftentimes as a colorist. You know, there are some black and white pictures in the book. I've done quite a bit of black and white. But I would say that people probably know me more recently as a color photographer.
Because you need to, if people haven't seen John's work, you can go to his website, and it's johnslaughterphotography.com.
Correct.
And it's great because there's all, and that's what I love about what you do, is there's wonderful categories. It's not just, you know, like a lot of times people focus on portraits or they focus on architecture, but you have like this great variety of what, of just what makes up life. And I was telling Patrice this on the way here that I found that as I look at a lot of your work, I forget sometimes what I'm looking at because I get so taken in by the color or the vibrancy of that color and trying to figure out how does one capture that.
Well, I also think there's, my interest in really, it seems to drift towards painters a lot. So, and I've had people sometimes confuse photographs I've taken with being paintings.
Okay.
So
that's who's been inspiration for, is painters.
Right. I mainly have studied painting more than photographers. You know, I mean, I usually go to museums and things to look at painters more than anything else. And, and a lot of friends that I've had are painters as well.
Who's has stood out for you over the years that has really had an influence on you?
You know, I don't think it's some specific thing. It's just, you know, I would say the other training for, in terms of composition, came from spending umpteenth hours when I was in college going to movies. When I was studying film, so I saw, at that time I watched like three or four films a week, which people, today that's nothing, but at that time, you know, wasn't that availability, and actually going to a theater, either on campus or off campus, to watch films. So I feel like a lot of my eye got trained watching films. But the other side of that, when I was in going to school near Chicago, was the idea of going to the Art Institute, which was at that time was free to students. Yeah. And anytime we would go downtown in the Loop in Chicago, I'd always leave a few minutes to drop into the Art Institute. And it was a great experience for a person like myself from Baton Rouge, which really at that time had no art museum, and I never had that experience where you can develop a real relationship with the museum, and you can go back and you can look at the same painting over and over and over again. You know, so you really have a, you know, it's just a great opportunity. And because it was free and so accessible right down in the Loop, where, you know, at times you would go to do things, it's just really nice to be able to just bop in, spend 5-10 minutes, go to a spot which you really liked, and a great impressions collection, and then, you know, go visit something you like to see again. And I think all that kind of enters your subconscious and affects what you do.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, I'm curious, have you ever or do you paint?
Not really. I did take a course when I was like my early 20s to convince myself I could actually draw. But when I figured out that I could actually do this, I didn't really understand the mystery of it so much. I kind of realized I could actually draw something. I just sort of lost interest in it. You know, I sometimes think about painting.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of like I'm getting kind of, I have so much expertise in this other program. It's kind of hard to run, start. I mean, I've seen what it takes to be a good painter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
I don't know if I'm really quite ready for that. You know?
You know, as you were doing this book, the, you know, the other thing that came to mind for me is because you have those, you know, 35 years of your work in this, I'm curious what you discovered about yourself as a photographer. You know, were there a couple things that stood out in terms of, wow, that really changed for me, or I really took a different direction at, you know?
I think the main thing for me was getting these images in the book, a lot of which had not been seen before. I mean, there are some that are really iconic in terms of my work that people know about.
Yeah.
So those I was too concerned about, but what I was really like was getting pictures in there that I knew that I had in my files, but I'd never taken out to show people.
Yeah.
They weren't quite what I would call exhibit grade, but they were pictures I really, really liked for whatever reason. And so this was an opportunity to finally get those exposed.
Was it overwhelming at all initially?
Well, it took a lot. You know, like I realized, this is one of the things I did realize, that part of our job as photographers is to be able to do filing. I mean, actually being able to access finding things is really a large part of what we need to be able to do. And also, you know, protecting your work, keeping it so it's accessible. And when you do find it, it's not all moldy and oldy.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to, so going, you know, that's, I never really learned a great system for that. I don't even know if there is a system for it. But, you know, and I did find some pictures. I mean, I went through everything. You know, just had boxes I would just go through and look at. And, I actually found a photograph that I didn't even remember taking.
Yeah, I bet.
And that was kind of an experience. The picture of Ben Wren, who's a Jesuit priest who's leading a Zen retreat. That was a picture when I came upon it, I mean, I had no recollection of having done it. But I was very happy it was because he was a fabulous person.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious, too, with the process with the two of you, you know, not having done any of this kind of work before, Patrice, how that worked for the two of you in terms of, you know, sorting through all those pictures. What stories, like what angle do I want to go at with this? How did that work for what did you guys do for that?
I gave Patrice small prints of the photos I thought we were going to use for the individuals. And I just said, here, you know, take these things and
see
go
what you
do
can
it.
Find out. Huh?
You know, because she has a real good connection with the community. I mean, she's been doing these events and so forth and had people come and so forth. And I just, I thought it would be an added dimension. I could have written these things. I could have done the interviews, but I thought it would be a good thing to have someone else's point of view in here.
Yeah.
As you know, I did write a bunch of photographer's notes. And I did write some of the captions because Patrice was more on her plate than she could actually do. And so in the time frame we had, so I didn't do a lot of them, but I did some of the captions, some that I knew a lot about personally.
Sure.
You know, where there wasn't any research to do, it was just knowing something about it. But I just thought it was good that she, you know, has good relationships with a lot of people in the community, and I thought she would enjoy doing the work, actually. I
mean, yeah.
And I think that's important. If you enjoy doing it, you get a better job.
Yeah, I
did enjoy it. And it did make sense for John to do some of them. Like there's a couple where there's houses burning. And so, what happened to that moment, it's obvious that the photographer would write that. And some, you know, there were interesting circumstances how the picture was taken. But it was a building. I might have done research, you know, through other resources, but then I would also talk to people if they were associated with that building. And it was interesting talking, but I guess when I saw the photographs, they were all gorgeous, you know, the landscapes, the architecture, but the people, I must admit, that's what drew me in the most.
Well, do you know what I remember is popping in at your place the one day, and you guys had some long tables set up, and you had those photographs. You had a number of photographs laid out on those tables, and you were sorting that day or picking or something. But it was fun listening to the two of you that day, you know, go through that. I'm not remembering that incorrectly.
No,
you guys did that.
I guess so. I didn't remember that.
Yeah,
but
I do.
I'm sure
I remember.
We did.
Do you remember doing that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I had this
idea. Because that was a neat thing for me to be able to see all those photographs on that table.
Yeah, I had this idea that I was going to order those pictures, and I was going to get all these little prints, and I was going to figure out the order in which they were going to appear in the book.
Yeah.
But then as we kind of got into the program, I realized that chronologically it would be a more logical method and would resolve all the issues about how they were going to go.
So
they gave a good framework. And so that's how it ended up. But initially I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, this one's going to follow this one.
Yeah,
that was going to follow
this
one. And all that got kind of changed. Well, they did get arranged within the year to a certain extent.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, so there is a little bit of arrangement. But you know, as I say, it's once you get beyond the introduction and the preface, it's chronological order, and that's how it's laid out.
What did you learn? Oh, go ahead, Preesh.
Oh, and those printed photographs, they needed to be printed for me because I would bring them to people and say, look at this. Can you tell me? And you know how when someone looks in a photograph, they go into their memories. It really and these particular photographs are so evocative that it really, that was the catalyst to get people talking.
Boy, what a great thing, because you know that you have been in situations where you try to get people talking about something just from you verbally asking them about it. And gosh, if you had a photo.
Oh, yeah, exactly that. And you know, if you, many people may in their family, they have family photographs and they might show an elder those photos and get them talking. That stimulates stories.
What did you learn about the community that you now call home? What were some things that really stood out for you?
It was, it was interesting, the parallels and stories, because I interviewed about 30 people, and sometimes I'd have to interview three people before I got to the actual person who had the information they were willing to share with me.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to see the historical parallels. For example, in 1927, the 1927 flood, I didn't realize how many lives that changed of the families in our area. That there was one person in the book, Mary Louise Charles, and she moved to Grand Coteau from an area, a lower area nearby called Prairie Boss.
Yeah.
And I'd hear that story again and again, how her family left the 1927 flood, and then she ended up staying in Grand Coteau. The rest of the family went back. But as I interviewed other people, I learned more information about people whose families moved to the area from that flood.
Yeah.
And even though I'd heard about it historically, it's different when you speak to people whose families were affected by it, and their futures were changed.
You know, I would imagine that you received some comments from people, or like expressions, just when somebody would first look at a photo, like, oh my gosh, wasn't that something, you know?
Yes, yes, oh yeah. And you know, it would take, sometimes I only needed a little bit of information, but the interview would last an hour because they really, sometimes I would end up in people's homes, especially elders, and they wanted to talk.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted to be heard.
That's right.
And they appreciated that. And I appreciated being allowed to talk to them, because they didn't know me that well. They didn't have to share it with me, but they agreed to, and I thought that was kind. And it's nice to live in a community where that can happen.
Yeah. Did you write as they talked, or did you record? How did you work on that?
I wasn't as set up well as I should have been with a recorder. I mostly wrote.
I jotted
down notes.
Yeah.
That they said, and then sometimes I would write something up, and I would come back to them and share with them what I'd written to make sure I hadn't made errors, and I had, you know, many occasions, and so I would try to correct it and get as close as I could.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're going to listen to another. We're not sure which cut this is going to be that John brought in, because we did a little re-recording while we were here. So, but this is going to be another reggae cut, and we'll find out which one after we play it. We're going to take a short break here.
Oh,
That, which we were lucky, was Lucky Dewey, which we thought was going to play initially. So where does reggae music come in for you, John?
Is that for years and years
that you've had an interest in reggae?
I just wanted to pick some music that was not too intense or too heavy.
Yeah.
And something that...
makes you happy.
You know, I think there's... And I just happen to know some songs that I think are really, really good.
Yeah.
I kind of got turned into by the Festival International.
Okay.
I've seen a lot of great reggae there.
Yeah.
And my son, for a while, was really into reggae.
Okay.
It was more just a thought that, as to give a little flavor to the program, I thought it would be a good way to, you know, a leitmotif in music, sort of like the leitmotif in these photographs. I mean,
that's right.
You know, these pictures were chosen for. We had a book release party where we showed pictures that did not make the book.
Ah, that's a cool thing to do.
And, you know, and so when I was going through there, you know, it was obvious to me that the ones that are in the book were selected because there is a certain concept involved.
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain feel that we were trying to get.
That's right.
And so even though I might have had a picture that was really, really good, if it didn't really feel like it fit the concept, it didn't make the book.
Yeah.
And we also, another thing is, even if we didn't, in most cases, the photograph, the quality of the photograph was the dominant issue, not the subject matter so much.
Yeah.
There are a few people in the book that I was happy to include, for lots of reasons because of who they are in the town and so forth, but there's some that I missed because I didn't have the photographs of them.
Sure. Well, if you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. You can also find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media. Thanks to everybody who supported the station during our fall fundraiser and who support the station year-round. You can always go to the website, and it's a safe, secure website, so you don't always have to wait for the fundraiser times, but thanks to everybody who turned out for that. If you are just joining us, my guest today in the studio is artist-photographer John Slaughter and writer Patrice Melnick, and they have collaborated on a project. It's actually John's first book. It's absolutely wonderful. It's beautiful. It's an art book, but also, boy, what an incredible amount of history on the town of Grand Coteau. And it's called Grand Coteau. I do want to mention that you can find out more about the book on the web if you go to grandcoteaubook.com. Also, there's a link to it to see some more of John's work at johnslaughterphotography.com. But, you know, I want to go back to what you were talking about with some of the people, John, that you have in this book. Boy, what an incredible amount of memories this had to, you know, to bring up for you for, you know, your life in that town for all those years that you have lived there now, you know?
It's a little frightening to imagine you've been in one place that long. I mean, you have to try to believe that you're still... You actually wake up and you're all of a sudden 63 years old.
Wow,
what happened there?
Yeah.
You know, so
a lot actually happened for you, but yeah, but I get that, you know.
We moved there because my wife got a job teaching in Sacred Heart, and it was a great place for a photographer. I mean, it's a beautiful place. And at the time, and I will say that's the one thing you mentioned earlier about what I noticed about doing the book was that when we first moved there, it was really a small town and relatively isolated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was the four lane out there, but it wasn't an interstate. And there was like one little fried chicken place, with a couple of gas pumps. So it was practically nothing. And the town was very insular at that time. And
yeah.
It was nowadays we have a tremendous number of people who are, it's a bedroom community beyond around us in our area. So we have a lot of people who drive through every day that, but back in the day, I mean, it was really pretty much simple little world,
Yeah.
And that has changed a lot. And it's just been being within the proximity of Lafayette, this larger metropolitan type of area. And so that has been other towns which are off the interstate further, like Arnoville or Cecilia, or,
sure.
Those towns probably still have that kind of, insulated kind of feeling. And we had that, but it's changed so much. And I think, in a sense, I really hope that the citizens of Wanko are conscious of trying to preserve a little bit of, the integrity of the place,
yeah.
Or keep that intact. And I think it still exists. It's just not as isolated as feeling as it used to be.
Yeah,
and that's one of the things I noticed while I was working on the book.
And you talk about that change happening in the town. Don't you think that the architecture was one of the main attractions that would bring people to that town? I mean, I know Academy of the Sacred Heart, that school has been there for, but the architecture in that town is incredible.
It's a really nice selection of what I consider not grandiose places.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly.
Like
that's a good way to put that.
You can go to other places when they're talking about their plantation homes and their Victorian mansions and so forth. Wanko is really a town more of cottages, and fortunately, most of them are there. I mean, they
mm-hmm.
exist. And
how much of that? I forget what the number is, but the number of buildings that are on the historic register.
It's
in
like
that town.
over 70.
Yeah,
probably more now because some have gone. You have to be 50 years old to be connected. Like the Retreat House did not qualify when it was put on the National Register, but now would qualify.
Sure, sure. And that. I mean, that's the thing that you hear about so much when people go through that town is they just like driving up and down the streets looking at the homes.
It's not particularly large, but it's effective.
Yeah.
And we also have, for a small town, due to the fact that, particularly because of the religious institutions and some large landowners, we have these large open areas, which are unusual and are incorporated within the city limits.
Yeah.
And we're even notated on the application for the National Register, the oak alleys and so forth.
Sure.
Are an important part of the program. And it's most unusual for a town to encapsulate that type of... I mean, a lot of the areas of Wanko feel like you really are in the country. You're no longer in a town.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. It's real... I was telling this story the other day to some people. We had gone picking pecans in an area, and we were in the middle of the town. I mean, the dead center now. We could hardly see anything.
Well, and the thing that always grabs me, too, is what is the name of the, the old yellow barn that sits back? Because that's the one that always grabs
that
me.
That comes from your part of the country. I mean, the idea of that is from Wisconsin and so forth.
The architecture of that barn. But what's the history of that building? Do you know?
I don't know. You're going to have to look it up.
Do you know
I don't
Patrice?
Remember.
I think it was built or designed by a Jesuit who was from Wisconsin or from that area.
Ah.
And so it was his
No,
design.
And this wasn't planned, folks. No, I didn't realize that. Oh.
Yeah.
Well, because that's when you're talking about being in the country. When I get over by that, that's when it's like, or where you're driving through Grand Coteau and you're actually in a town setting, and then you just look right over and you see that, you're taken to a whole nother place,
It was like right in early 1900. I don't remember the exact year.
Yeah. Patrice, the town that you live in now that has, I said become home for you, what did you learn about the history from John's photographs? What did you learn about the town?
About the town from the photographs?
Yeah, from his photographs. What did you learn?
What... I guess what struck me, you know, that I'd seen, but it's brought out more, is just there's so much green. I mean, a lot of it is also, in addition to the architecture, it's about the green and those vast expanses of space. And I think psychologically they have an effect on you.
Yeah.
And I think just looking through the photographs, it's sort of something I took for granted, but it brought it to the forefront.
Yeah. It's one of those communities that the minute, well, for me, I don't live there, but the minute that I drive in there or get out of my vehicle, there's something that you just kind of relax.
But something else I learned from the interviews, if I may bring that up,
is
you were talking about commonalities, and most of the elders that I interviewed, the Creole people, what they had in common was that were institutions that are no longer there. And that was kind of interesting to me, like St. Peter Claver High School. Every Creole person in town was educated there, just about, if they could go to school,
yeah.
if they weren't working in the field or working for their family.
Where was that located?
That's where the Thensted Center is now.
Ah.
That's at old St. Peter Claver High School. And so I learned about it from these interviews. And, in fact, there's going to be a tour of that on Saturday, by the way, at 10 a.m. if anyone's interested. And the old Christ the King Church, which is now St. Charles Chapel.
Yeah.
Everyone went to church there, and that was their community. It revolved around it. And so it's interesting hearing the story over and over again, but the institution's gone, in a sense.
Oh, yeah. But that history, I mean, that's where things like this book are really nice. You know, it brings back a lot of that history that people forgot about, you know. So, John, you are to be commended on that.
Well, thank
for
you.
For doing this book.
One thing I would like to point out is that we have a huge religious presence in the town, through the Catholic Church predominantly. And I think one of the great things about that is because it's an institution and because it's not geared to somebody's lifespan or inheritance in typical manner, is that they've preserved these, you know, vistas and these buildings and these grounds and everything. And there are a lot of photos that are attributed to that fact, you know.
Yeah.
They've been very good caretakers of the environment to most extent, you know.
That's right.
And so we're fortunate in the way they're there.
Yeah, that's right. Do you have, and I don't know if this is a fair question or not, but do you have favorites of some of these photographs?
I think some of them are better than others.
So your favorites are based on the work part of it rather than...
Well, there's a few pictures in there. I've told people that if I could take one of these a year, I'd be very happy.
Ah.
I would say the two photographs...
What's one out of here?
Well, I think the picture of the Olivier store a la Charles, which has been a very popular photograph over the years. That one and the picture of the man, the watermelon wagon. Those are two. I used to have a card business for a while where we did greeting cards with photos on them and so forth. It was like,
wait, you had cards. See, that's the first place I ever saw your work was because of your.
Well, those were two images I refused to put on cards.
Ah,
I said, if you want to access this, you cannot buy this for $3 or whatever it was at that time.
Yeah, because why? Why?
Well, they're just such good photographs. That's just not the right medium for them. They're too good to be portrayed as a cheap, inexpensive print.
Sure, exactly.
So, and I think there's a few others like that, but those are two that always come to mind. And strangely enough, those two photographs have frequently been bought as a pair.
Ah.
And maybe because of the banana leaves.
Huh.
I don't really know.
Yeah. Do you have some out of here or like one or two that you're very emotionally connected to?
I did speak about Ben Wren, the Zen master, the Jesuit Zen master. I think that's, the picture of Lu Xiaoli, that's pretty emotional.
Which one is that?
Aloysius Ivy, Lu Xiaoli.
Okay.
It's kind of hard to explain that one.
He was
just a really interesting man.
Yeah.
It's like you run across these people every once in a while in your life that just defy category. He was one of those people.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful book. I want to tell people to check out, you can go to grandcoteaubook.com, and it lays out just some samples from this book, Grand Coteau, in there, and some of the writings, the captions, and some of the photographer's notes in there also. Also go to johnslaughterphotography.com. I'm going to throw one more thing in there for Festival of Words. This weekend, people can go to, if you actually search for Festival of Words, Grand Coteau, it comes up all over the place.
Right. You can do that. And the book's available also in town in Grand Coteau. You can pick it up at the bookstores, at the gift shops there, including Casa Azul.
Do you have another signing coming up soon, John?
We'll have a signing at Barnes & Noble in Lafayette in December, and also in Baton Rouge in December, and also at Pieces of Eight in December.
And you'll have those listed on the grandcoteaubook.com website.
I don't think those are listed. As a matter of fact, I don't think that's on there.
Yeah.
But also, we'll be at Christmas at Coteau, which is at Sacred Heart, which is also in December. So there'll be a number of times in December. And also, if you come to Grand Coteau and go to either a kitchen shop or Casa Azul and you want a signed book or you want something, I'll be glad to kind of get by there and do it for you, or so forth. I mean, that's our local friends and bookstores.
Very good. Well, John Slaughter, Patrice Melnick, thank you so much for coming on today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Beautiful, beautiful piece of art here. We're going to go out listening to Clifton Chenier, Alonzo Grand Coteau. Have a good week, everyone.
Go vote.
Go vote.